fiction feeds your fantasy. A little fiction dampens the reality. A little fiction. Hello and welcome to The Writing Cast. I'm your host, Ivy Reisner, and this is episode 83, an interview with Catherine Howe.
So I have with me today Catherine Howe, the author of The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Can you tell me something about yourself?
Well, I was born in 1977, I was in graduate school. The way that the book started, actually, that's probably the most interesting thing, is I was in graduate school for American and New England Studies, and it was 2005, and I was studying for my qualifying exam, which is a big exam that happens right in the middle of a PhD program, and where basically what you do is you slink off into a corner and read 400-odd books, and eventually then you're invited into a room with a panel of dour professors who ask you whatever they want, and it's kind of terrifying. And so the way that I was sort of escaping this anxiety was that my husband and I had just moved to Marblehead, Massachusetts, which is only one town over from Salem. And so to kind of free myself from the fear and recrimination of preparing for my qualifying exam was to take my dog walking in the woods between Marblehead and Salem. And I kind of started telling myself stories to distract myself at that time. And it was at that point that I started coming up with the idea for the physics book.
Cool. Your degree is in history, isn't it?
It's in American and New England Studies, which is like interdisciplinary history. It's like the history of American culture.
Wow. And that's very similar to what Connie was studying. So it's a kind of a...
Although a lot of people make that connection, except that I like to point out that Connie is an infinitely better student than I am, because she was actually working hard on her stuff, while as instead of hard work on my dissertation, I was kind of spending a lot of time on the novel and on teaching and not making a lot of progress on my own research. So Connie wins in the student department for sure.
But it sounds like it plays into that write what you know sort of thing, because of course the history stuff that she's doing and the research and talking to Professor Chilling and all of that is very compelling, because you really do have that firsthand experience.
Thank you. I think it's kind of, it's fun. I think that there's a lot of narrative potential in academia. You know, I think it's funny when you turn on the television and there are a lot of professions that are represented. I think this is true in popular fiction as well. You see doctors a lot, you see lawyers a lot. And I mean, I think it is a kind of a truism of writing that you should stick with what you know. And so certainly that was the academic context, was the framework from which I was coming. But I also think that there are a lot of stories to be had there. I mean, there are a lot of kind of interesting characters who are attracted to academia, and also interesting work that's being done, a lot of which you can build on with sufficient imagination to make a really great story. I had a lot of fun with it.
Okay.
I really enjoyed, you know, kind of building on academic research to kind of come up with a fun and exciting story. And of course, history is a great place to mine for story ideas and for narrative things. And so,
a lot of interesting figures in history. You have a lot of thematic stuff going on with your two magic systems. You've got witchcraft on the one side, and that's historically associated with women and with the West. And then you've got alchemy on the other side, which is associated with men and with the East. How did that dichotomy come about?
I was interested by kind of the relationship between the two. I mean, in addition to the dichotomy, sort of witchcraft, women, West, alchemy, men, East, there's also a sense of the intrinsic and the extrinsic. There was, in the reading that I was doing, there was an idea that that witchcraft was also kind of a moral category, that in the study of history, you know, if you were suspected of being a witch, it had a lot to do with your position in society. People who were suspected of witchcraft were usually on the fringes of their world. They were usually kind of socioeconomically marginal, and it was often a way of kind of purging unwanted elements from the society. And that contrasted really drastically with this sort of alchemical notion of the perfectibility of the self or the perfectibility of the soul, and the fact that alchemy was a pursuit that men did. I think probably the most famous practitioner of alchemy was Isaac Newton. There was a sense that not only could you attain perfect knowledge of how the world works, but you could also obtain kind of perfect control both of the world and also of yourself. And so it seemed very much kind of in keeping with an academic frame of mind, the idea that through study and discipline you could obtain some kind of abstract ideal, whereas it seemed with witchcraft there was something more kind of intrinsic having to do with the self, and of course in history often with a negative connotation. And so it seemed like a kind of productive contrast between the known and or the assumed or the whatever you kind of contain within yourself and the learned and the kind of thing that you might want to pursue. And yet in many respects there's so much kind of overlap between the two and the way that they were both supposed to work, and historically speaking. And I was very interested by that. I felt like witchcraft and alchemy were kind of two sides or two different ways of talking about a similar body of knowledge or a similar goal.
You've also got that kind of a dichotomy or a split going between alchemy and chemistry, because chemistry being the child of alchemy would have come later,
yes.
But in the story, chemistry drives the problem first in the 1690s, and then alchemy drives the problem in the 1990s, so it's another sort of, I guess, parallel going on there.
Yeah, no, it's true. And one thing I was interested in is that we have the sense that the way that we think about things is somehow transhistorical. That we have this that our habits of mind exist kind of independent of the time in which we're living. I mean, I think this is funny. Whenever we think about time travel, like, you know, a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court or something like that, you know, what would I be like if I lived in a different time period? But of course, I would not be me in a different time period, because the way that I think is itself historically contingent. And so, you know, the signal difference between alchemy and chemistry was about trial and error and cause and effect and the scientific method. And that was something that was interesting to me, to kind of rediscover the fact that the scientific method is a historic idea, is not a natural way of thinking. And so that was something I was kind of curious about exploring in the story as well, to kind of try to understand what the world would look like through a different habit of mind a little bit.
You've got a lot going on. It's an amazingly rich story.
Thank you. I also wanted it to be fun. I mean, you know, to explore some of these ideas, but in a way that was kind of, you know, pleasurable and that would be fun and escapist to pick up and read.
Is this actually your first book?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was doing a lot of, I have academic writing in background and, you know, accustomed to writing in an academic way, but of course, compared to academic writing, novel writing felt kind of easy because I don't have to use footnotes or anything like that. You can kind of make it up in between, and so I felt kind of like I was playing hooky by writing fiction that way. Not that fiction is easy, just that it requires a different kind of rigor, and that I found really refreshing.
And going back to the magic system for a second, the one that Deliverance Dane uses, and the sigils and the icons that they're finding throughout Salem, is that built on an existing magic or a historic magic system, or is that, like, you have the sign on her door and all that?
It is, to some extent, actually. As a matter of fact, it is. I mean, I think if you go around, we're very accustomed to, say, going around and seeing old horseshoes nailed over doors, for instance. And in fact, when we moved into our first little apartment in Marblehead has one of the biggest collections of 18th century housing stock in the entire country, and I started seeing horseshoes nailed over doors all over the place. And it's something, it's like a kind of a symbol that we don't even notice because it permeates our culture of belief so thoroughly. I mean, it's so horseshoes as a symbol of protection or good luck are so built into our culture that they are in Lucky Charm cereal. I mean, that's how kind of unnoticeable they are. And there's also, the boundary marker that shows up in the story is based on a real boundary marker. It's called the Witch Stone, and it's in Byfield Parish, Massachusetts, which is north of Salem, on sort of the outskirts of Newburyport, far in the north, up close to New Hampshire and Maine. And this is a carved boundary marker. It dates from about the 1650s, although they don't have a specific date on it. And it has a man carved on it with kind of a grimacing face. You can, if you actually want to see a picture of it, I posted one on my Facebook page. And it's very scary. It's this guy with his arms sticking out and weird kind of circles all around him. And so there was this sense of kind of folk magical belief or folk magical practice that did permeate New England's culture at that time. And some of it was kind of imported from England, and some of the kind of English ways of thinking were sort of borrowed from Inquisition era beliefs in early modern continental Europe. But some of it was kind of indigenous. And so that's another thing that I was kind of interested to think about, that we overlook the fact when we talk about Salem, you know, the word we use most often when we talk about the Salem witch crisis is hysteria, right? We have this very kind of Freudian response when we try to talk about Salem. But what was interesting to me as a historian was to think about the fact, and this gets back kind of to my little habits of mind idea, like the people who were caught up in the panic actually believed that witchcraft was real. They really did. I mean, it was against the law, and in order to have something be against the law, you have to some extent, believe in it. I mean, not everyone believed in it to the same degree, obviously. There were variations of belief, but it was a real belief. People lived in a world of, one historian has called it, a world of wonders and marvels, in which the spirit, you know, world is all around them and manifest all the time. And so it was important to me to kind of, in thinking about the story, to imagine, you know, what would it feel like to live in a world that you really believe to be infused with magic and signs and significance all the time? And it would just look very different from the way that we see the world today. And so so a lot of the stuff that is in the story is actually derived from the historical record. Of course, some of it has been kind of added in by my imagination or embellished somewhat. But like for instance, the sign on the door that appears in the story is taken out of a secondary source magic book that I was reading, The History of Occult and Magical Thoughts.
I think it's
that was a long answer. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's cool that there's like so many in all of these things. So many languages. I think one of the symbols had Hebrew, Greek, and Latin all in one.
Yes, which actually kind of echoes a lot of sort of magical thought at that time. I mean, if you see like charms and things like that, a lot of them kind of blend these sort of half-remembered antique knowledges. And I think a lot of it also has to do with kind of changes in attitudes during the Reformation. You know, we have this sense, especially in the history of witchcraft, that whatever is the dominant belief system is going to try to mark the alternative belief system as the other, and as somehow lesser or dangerous or threatening. This is the case during the Inquisition, in which there's a very infamous kind of witch-hunting manual called the Malleus Maleficarum, or the Hammer of the Witches, which is where a lot of our kind of ideas of what a witch is, our definition, or how we identify a witch, both us today and also for the colonists, a lot of those ideas are found in this text that was written in Germany in 1486. But by the time you get to New England and the colonial period, you know, the dominant belief system is Calvinist Protestantism. And so any sort of remnants of, let's say, Catholic belief, there's actually a very famous case in the early colonies in Massachusetts of a woman who was accused of witchcraft who was Irish. And one of the reasons that she couldn't defend herself is because she didn't speak English. She only spoke Irish, and so she didn't understand what she was being accused of, and she couldn't really defend herself. She would have been Catholic, and so she would have had all these sort of more kind of Catholic beliefs that would have been out of step with the religious mainstream at that time. So witchcraft is often, or accusations of witchcraft are often about marking the other, or marking the belief that is not in step with the dogmatic mainstream.
And with names with this book, you've got another level of stuff going on. You've got Goodwin on the one side, and then you've got Chilton, that cold image there, on the other side. And then you've got the names that have more direct deliverance, mercy, constance, grace going on.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
How did you decide, like, how far to drive, then how far away from the obvious to take the name? Some are pretty subtle and some are blatant. How do you balance that?
It's true. I think for most of the names, I find it kind of challenging, and maybe a lot of writers have this problem, but to come up with names that felt like they could be actual people, I found kind of challenging and difficult. But I also wanted to have names that seemed appropriate thematically to each person who carried it. So the protagonist is Connie Goodwin. And I picked Goodwin for a couple of reasons. One, to get a lot of a New England appropriate names, I actually looked around not only in the historic record, but also around town here in Marblehead. We have little plaques on most of the old houses who say the names of the person for whom the house was originally built. So there are a lot of names that show up in this story that are names that I just tore off the face of houses. You know, Bartlett is a name that you see around here a lot. Goodwin is actually a name that you see in Marblehead. And, of course, Good and Win. I mean, it seemed like a kind of appropriate protagonist last name. By extension, Chilton, who is our nemesis in the story, there's the obvious connotation of chill, you know, cold. But also, Chilton was the name of the first woman who set foot off the Mayflower. So it's this very, her name is Mary Chilton. So it's a very kind of old-fashioned, kind of proper, fancy Boston name. And so it seemed right not only for a nemesis, but also for a nemesis of the particular kind that Chilton was. You know, sort of fancy, pleased with himself, about to be maybe outdated, things like that. The name Deliverance Dane was actually a real person, so I didn't make that one up. she was a real person, and I was, when I came upon it, unlike a lot of the Salem people who we are kind of already familiar with, you know, those of us who've read the Crucible, which is, I think, how most of us encounter the Salem story first, we already kind of know Rebecca Nurse, we already know Elizabeth Proctor, you know, we know all these people. But Deliverance was one of the sort of the last wave of people to be accused. She lived up in Andover, and Andover was kind of the second wave of the Salem witch crisis and had as many people accused from Andover as were from the Salem area. And so but her name, I thought, was just so incredibly evocative. I mean, it's the most kind of Puritan sounding name, you know, Deliverance. I was really struck by it, and so I was interested in kind of, I've always sort of been partial to names derived from virtues, especially because they're so very old-fashioned, and so I did get a little carried away with the virtues names, but a lot of the names derived from virtues are still in kind of common use, and so that's one of the reasons that Connie's mom is named Grace. I think at first when you see the name Grace, you kind of forget that it's a virtue at first. It seems like a name first, maybe. So I, with naming, that was kind of my strategy, was trying to make them kind of relevant and part of building what we know about the character, but also relevant to the time period where the character lived and also the region where the character lived.
And you've also got a sort of a feminist, just maybe subtext floating only occasionally into text going on with the book. Also very subtle.
Thank you.
Was that in there from the beginning, or did that kind of evolve with the story?
Sorry, do you mean the kind of movement between the past story and the present story?
I mean, from the conception of the story to the final draft, was that feminist aspect always there, or did it sort of present itself as you were writing?
I actually wrote from a pretty substantial outline. While putting the story together, I kind of came up with the broad contours of it and came up with the characters that I wanted to use. And then for me to work out pacing and to work out moving between the times and to work out who knows what when, I needed a visual way to do it. And so I worked out a pretty big, I actually used a spreadsheet with characters and ideas down one side and chapter headings at the top. And so by the time I'd kind of sketched out the outline, there wasn't a whole lot of deviation from the story ideas. It changed a little bit as I worked through the outline, and I did have to kind of go back as I was halfway through and ground myself a little bit better in the history of alchemy, because I was pretty well based in the history of witchcraft, but alchemy was something I'm more of an autodidact when it comes to the history of alchemy. And so I did have to kind of go back and revise and double-check myself here and there. But basically, the final structure of the story was not all that very different from what I imagined it to be when I started to think about, just to conceptualize it. Was that what you were asking, or did I misunderstand?
Yeah, no, that was pretty much it. When did you know you wanted to be a fiction writer?
Sorry, when did I want to be a fiction writer?
Yeah, when did you know you really had a book in you, you wanted to tell the story?
I'm trying to figure out a way to answer the question that doesn't sound hopelessly cheesy, because I wanted to be a fiction writer when I was a kid. But of course, I didn't think it was a very practical, you know, way to try to go professionally. And so I thought that one way to kind of make my life as a writer that would be more practical would be to be an academic. And so I'd spent a long time kind of in the academic world, teaching academic writing to undergrads and doing my own research and things like that. And so pretty much what happened was, I started thinking that I might have an actual book in me while I was studying for this exam. I started working, sort of sketching it out mostly to entertain myself. And then after I passed the exam and I was working on my dissertation idea, my dissertation idea kept being shot down. I'd come up with it this way, and I would propose it, and they'd say no. And I'd come up with it, I'd revise it, and they'd say no. And meanwhile, just to keep myself going, I continued to work on the novel. And I'd always done kind of creative writing on my own pretty much my entire life, just to amuse myself, just, personal essays or like little short stories or little sketches or whatever. I would write pretty much every day. But I'd never attempted to do a large, coherent, and consistent long-form project before. Until I was trying to think about my dissertation, strangely enough, and it was only in the course of absolutely failing to do my dissertation that I was actually successful at putting a long-form fiction piece together. I came up with the idea and started sketching it out and realized that it did make sense as a novel, that it was, because of course another thing I was thinking about was, oh great, Salem, that's what we need, another Salem witch book, right? I mean, there's no shortage of fiction and nonfiction that look at that subject. And so for a while I had to decide if I could give myself permission to write about it the way that I wanted to write about it. And so I finally was able to kind of do it. And so I guess it was when I was about, sorry, I'm walking. and so it was probably, about, I don't know, 4 years ago that it started to seem like a real possibility.
Wow. So you worked, this was a long, long work for you.
It took a while. I mean, I started thinking about it, as I said, in 2005. And then I wasn't sure if I'd be able to do it or if I would, you know, or if it would work. And yet I was doing all this research. And so I didn't want the research to go to waste. And so while I was thinking about it, I proposed and taught a class on the history of New England witchcraft for undergrads. And because I think the best way to learn something is to have to teach it to somebody else. And so I was working on that and kind of keeping my hand in my head in the period and in the details of the period while I have ways to put the story together. And of course I was trying to also kind of get my dissertation off the ground. And so I was kind of juggling a lot of things, and there was a long while where I spent more time talking about how I was going to write a book than I spent actually writing the book. And finally I had a very good friend, actually, who's also a writer, who finally kind of shook me by the shoulders and said, listen, you know, do it or don't do it. It's very Yoda, like, there is no try. You do or do not do. Which was kind of, I thought, very important. I mean, it was important to have support networks around me who could say, it's okay to spend the time doing this project. I mean, I think one of the things that's hard for people who are writers or who want to write is giving themselves permission to do it, to work on that instead of the practical thing, or to work on writing instead of, you know, home repair, or there's so many other drains on our time, and to be selfish enough with your time to have the writing occur. I think it takes a lot of support, and I think it's important to have your friends and family validate that choice to some extent.
So when's your next book coming out?
Well, the paperback, the physic book, is going to come out in April. And then the next novel, I think, is scheduled for summer of 2011.
And working title?
Its working title is The Scrying Glass, which is spelled S-C-R-Y-I-N-G.
Cool. Any preview of what it's going to be about?
It'll be similar in tone and theme to physic books, so it'll be also historic, but in a different period. It'll take place in Boston in the teens, and we'll also visit an unusual family, although they'll be different from the Goodwins. And I think it's going to be good. It's going to be different.
And it's going to be fantasy again, yes?
I'm sorry?
Fantasy genre?
I would call it kind of historical occult. I mean, I think it would be the same genre that physic book is, and I'm not really sure what genre that is exactly. It's kind of, there's a fantasy element to it, but it's also to appeal to readers of historical fiction and readers of kind of more sort of thriller fiction as well.
Okay. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you'd like to bring up?
Could I plug the website? Is that okay?
Please do.
Yeah, I just wanted, if people want to keep up with me or get news about seeing where I'm going to be or when the new book is coming out, they could visit my website, which is www.katherinehowe.com. And also, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. You can catch up with me there, too.
And I will link to that in the show notes.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I think I started following you on Twitter not too long ago.
Yeah.
Stalking you.
So, again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your inviting me. Okay. I really appreciate it.
Okay, good luck. And that should wrap us up for this time. Until next week, feed the muse and keep writing. Some of the music provided tonight from the Pod Show, PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.
Look up and reach down to a box of dreams and pick anyone you like. Choose the one that will make you the happiest, but you gotta picture it from our